Okay, we're live. Any questions before we get started today?
None so far.
So, like I said, we didn't end up lecturing on Friday. And I need to send Ryan an email. He sent me an email saying he did get out collecting some this weekend and sent me a picture of those giant spiders. And Argiope. Probably is an Argiope, but I call them just a giant garden spider, but I think some people call them yellow and black garden spider or something. So, but I need to answer him, but I was waiting until after we got this lecture in to see what we were doing today. So he's been out collecting. That's good. Mm-hmm. So today, and you'll notice I got the clock running. So today we'll continue with the classification and nomenclature lecture. We should finish it up today. And like I said, we're probably going to be in on still inside here on Thursday. And we'll probably be starting the other arthropod lectures then on Thursday. That's what I gave up. I'm not going to have the lecture outlines for everything. I just happened to do it for other arthropods, and I was looking today maybe for the Aterygota, and then from then on, I think it's just kind of write notes on the pictures and stuff. But the handouts I gave are just a lot of pictures, and we've got those kind of things made up for the whole rest of the semester. So you may end up with a couple binders full. It'll almost be like a field guide to the insects of our area up here. But I've got, as I said, I'm kind of old school. I have overheads of all the same pictures, and so when we get to that, I'll have the overheads up here, and I can point things out and mark on them and stuff. So, but today it's still just classification and nomenclature. Again, you have my notes, the lecture outlines, and everything, and I can write on the whiteboard a little bit. If I remember last time, we just went through all the different kinds of types, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, we stopped after the biological species concept.
Yeah, okay, and that's where I was going to pick up. We'll just kind of rehash that biological species. We're going to kind of go through the different levels of categories, talk about species a little bit and subspecies a little bit, then genera, then the family level stuff. So, like I said, species, and I mentioned this one other time, is the lower category, and we actually do have a definition of what a species is. It doesn't work for everything, but it works for most things, and it is that biological species definition. And as we said last time, it's a group of individuals or populations in nature that are capable of interbreeding and producing fertile offspring, and that they are reproductively isolated from other such groups. Now, what do we mean by reproductively isolated? I think most of the time what pops in your head is that they occur in different geographical areas, right? You got a species here and you got one there. But it doesn't even have to be that. It can be the genitalia are different so that they can't physically mate. Mm-hmm. They may have different pheromones so that they, when they call for the mates, they don't respond to each other. But it can also be other things that you don't always think of. I mean, it could be a habitat thing, that you may have two species that are real similar, and one lives down low in the grass and one lives way up in the trees, and they just never come together, so they're reproductively isolated. Or it can be a time thing. You can have two species in the same area, but one occurs in the spring and dies out then, and the other one occurs in the fall. So they're never together at the same time that way. So, you know, the point is, don't get locked into they're geographically isolated. That's what we think of for most of them. But there can be all kinds of things that, and it could be genetics. I was going to talk about it a little bit later, but in the group I worked on, there's two species of the stink bug in the U.S. that look identical. Even the genitalia is just the same. Mm-hmm. But other people had earlier done some work and noticed that they had different chromosome numbers. One had 14 chromosomes and the other one had 16 chromosomes. And that was part of my dissertation. I got a little small grant from a couple different places. And actually, it was my honeymoon, too. I just got married, and grant money paid for us, to my wife and I, to drive way out to the western U.S., Southern California and that, so I could collect specimens of that species there, and I could get all I wanted in Louisiana of the other one. And so I set up then the breeding studies. And that was a part of the point I was going to get to, is even though we have this definition, reproductively isolated, for most things you can't check that. I mean, most species, when we're working on them, all we have are pinned specimens in a museum. Mm-hmm. So how can you test whether they're reproductively isolated or not? You can't go out for every single case that you're worried about, collect real specimens and bring them into the lab and do interbreeding studies and see. And again, some of it's timing and everything. So, but anyway, I tried to do that, and it worked. I got specimens of both and tried the interbreeding studies, and they would mate with each other and lay eggs. But even some of the eggs hatched, and I was able to rear immatures all the way out to the adult stage, even of these crosses. But they wouldn't mate and wouldn't produce offspring, so they weren't fertile. So, and eventually I figured out some ways to kind of tell them apart, at least from their geographical areas. So, what we need to think about is, when we're talking about species, is we're taking a snippet in evolutionary time, you know, right here. But you kind of got to think more of like a family tree, that you've got a species here, and for some reason or another, it may split into two, and another split may occur, you know, and so we end up having speciation with all these different species. May another one come up here. And then, of course, things are going extinct, so all of a sudden you may have one not there anymore. But what we're talking about is evolutionary time. You may take a snippet, you know, through here, and at this point in time, there's three species that are related to each other. Take a snippet of time, if we're in the future, all of a sudden there's one, this one, well, this one's still here, hadn't gone out, but there could be five or six. We might take a snippet, and depending on where you're going right through here, mm-hmm. where they're just starting to split, and you can kind of tell them apart, but they're still real closely related. And this is what we would call sibling species. That they're just beginning that process of splitting apart. So sibling species, these are pairs or groups of very closely related species that are essentially morphologically identical. It is nearly impossible to tell them apart, but they are reproductively isolated. So, when they're just starting to speciate. Okay. And so they're still almost identical to each other, but they're not, I mean, again, you could be geographical. You could have one in California and one in Florida, and they're just not, but there's enough differences that they are two different species. So, sibling species are two species that are almost identical, just starting to diverge. We have another term called polymorphic species. What do you think polymorphic species would be?
So right next to each other. Polymorphic probably means poly being, they're very different from each other, I suppose.
Well, poly means many. Mm-hmm. And morphic is shape or form.
So is that a species that's not quite reproductively isolated but has like different forms?
Well, and when we talk about polymorphic species, we're really not talking about them splitting apart or anything. It just is one species that's very variable. See up here, when we're talking about sibling species, they all look the same, even the two. But a polymorphic species, and it could be just one of them, like right here, but it has lots of different forms. In my group, some of the predatory stink bugs And some of the others too. They just, they're really colorful in blacks and reds and stuff, but they'll be in so many different patterns, and some are metallic blue and some are metallic green. That there's some where they've named the species and thinking that they were all separate species. 10, 15, 20 times they've renamed the species, each different form. And people have gone back, they look at them structurally, and there's no difference in their structure. The male genitalia looks the same. Everything else looks the same. They're just different color forms. And they have gone in and done some of these mating studies and can mate two that look identical to each other, and all their offspring looks. And so basically, it's polymorphic is just one species, but it has lots of different forms. It's kind of the opposite of what's going on up here, where you... So, and then there's also another one, a term that's called polytypic species. Yeah, I shouldn't have put the devil in, just meant polytypic. What they're talking about there is now when you're getting into have a single species and it may have a large population, and then all of a sudden somebody notices that these look different, and maybe these have some difference, and yet they still think it's all one species, but it has these populations more. This polymorphic, they're all mixed in. They're not different populations. They're just variation all within the whole thing. Whereas polytypic would be, okay, this all looks like it. It's got to be one species, but these are a little bit different, and these are a little bit different. And so that's where we start, where they start talking about then subspecies.
So polytypic
is more where you're talking about whether it has subspecies or not.
So is polymorphic kind of like when you have winged versus wingless species, members of the same species?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of those even have intermediates. You'll have short wings, but it can be all mixed in the same population. Long-winged ones, short-winged ones, medium-sized winged ones.
Okay.
Now, subspecies, it's kind of a harder concept to deal with. And people have used subspecies in a lot of different ways and stuff. There actually is some rules or guidelines to go by. But for me, for a subspecies, again, I'll just erase this for a second. What I like to see, if I'm talking about subspecies, is you've got a population here, and then the other population comes in here, something like this. So we've got two different populations of this species, and pretty much 80 to 90% of the time, these and these look different. You can just tell them apart. And yet, I think there should only be a very narrow range of overlap of the two populations. I don't like them. For my definition, I don't like to be a broad range. Then we're getting more into the polymorphic again, if they're all spread out. But then within this little range of overlap, you see intermediates. Not a lot of intermediates, but a few intermediates. Mm-hmm. So it tells me if they still can, they're not reproductively isolated. They can still mate with each other and form fertile offspring. But essentially, there's two distinct populations. And so this is what I go by when I recognize subspecies, is I like to see two populations. There actually is a rule. It kind of goes, if like 75% of these, you can pick 75% of these and tell them apart from these 97% of the time or something, is some rule. I don't usually have any numbers or anything, but I just like to be able to say, you know, pretty much everything over here is one thing, everything over here is something else. They do come together in a little overlap in their populations, and you can find intermediates in between. That's what I would call a subspecies. We have some situations in North America, a couple of our common brown stink bugs in the genus Eucystis that right now are considered to be subspecies, but there's a broad range of overlap. I mean, up here, there's in both cases, there's a northern population and a southern population. And up here, everything looks like one thing, and down south, it's always looks like something else. But the range of overlap is really broad. It's not a narrow thing, and there's lots of intermediates in between. And I don't think they've gone far enough apart to call them subspecies. Plus, some of the characters that separate the two subspecies are environmentally controlled. If you rear them in the laboratory under like long day length, they'll look more like the southern population. You'd rear them in short day length, they look more like the northern. So there's some students in Brazil that are studying this. I'm helping them a little bit with it, that I've been trying to guide them towards synonymizing them or saying they're not good subspecies. In the case of the broad overlap, well, even, I mean, it can be another situation. If you can tell these two apart, in some cases you look clear over in this part of their population and there will be a character that you look at. And you look at the character over here, the same character, and it's very different. And you think, wow, those things are very different. They've got to be two different things. But if you start sampling in between, all of a sudden you see this character just gradually changes from one to the other. And in that case, we call that character a cline. Again, I keep drawing examples from my stink bugs. But
could you repeat that concept?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Again, from my dissertation work, there's a species of, I worked on the genus Thyanta. They're green stink bugs, mostly green. And there's one species that occurs all the way across the United States, from East Coast all the way to the West Coast. If you look on the underneath side, there's a black spot around each spiracle. In the east, you know, the segments are like this, and the spiracles are right there, and there'll be a nice black spot around each one. Mm-hmm. Way out here in the west, there's the spiracles, and there's no black spot at all. And you look at it and you say, wow, that's a pretty good, I mean, in color, you don't like going color, but it is a nice difference. Well, if you look, you know, this is East Coast. If you go to, say, Indiana, there's the spiracles. And now they still have a black spot, but it's much smaller. And you go out here to Wyoming, there's the spiracles, and there'll be just a little hint of a black spot. So this character at the opposite ends looks very different, but if you take samples all the way, you can tell it's just slowly, as you go across the U.S., that black spot gets smaller and smaller on individuals. And that's what they call a cline. Now, I should just mention a couple terms in here, too. People see these different situations, subspecies, species, differently. We can't always do the research, the intermating research on that. And so we're having to rely on looking at characters and stuff. And people see those differently. And you'll see that some people don't allow for any variation at all. Mm-hmm. Anytime they see something different, oh, that's a new species or a new subspecies. And we call those kind of people splitters. Every time they see something different, split it into two. Oh, those are two more. Of course, on the opposite end, and again, it's a gradient. Not everybody's, you know, it's not polar, but Those who tend to split things or into lots of little groups are called splitters. Other people say, oh, that's all just variation within one thing, you know. And those people are then called lumpers. Good taxonomic terms. Taxonomists get categorized themselves as splitters or lumpers. So, at the higher levels, I guess I often tend to be more of a splitter than a lumper. I don't know. I don't know. At the lower levels, I think I'm more objective, but I'm talking about, like we've talked about, tiger beetles are being lumped in with the ground beetles. That mm-hmm. just bothers me. I'd rather keep them split up. And in the Heteroptera, in my group, the Lygiidae was a huge family. And when they did the cladistic analyses and all that phylogenetic stuff, they kind of said, well, it's not monophyletic. And to make it monophyletic, we either got to add some more groups in and make it even bigger, or we got to split all these up into lots of little monophyletic groups. And that's what they ended up doing. They split the Lygiidae up into a lot of different families. And I like that a lot better, because each of those families still, they look different from each other. Mm-hmm. So, and so anyway, lumpers and splitters. And I just talked about Klein. Gotta make sure I don't miss things here. Yeah, I asked about whether I thought this was a valid category. And I do, like I said, if it fits this definition. I remember when I first started working in this thing, I went and worked with a guy at the Smithsonian for a few weeks, and he was fairly young too at the time. We were still pretty good friends. But early on, he said he didn't believe in subspecies and he didn't believe in subgenera. And at the time, I was recognizing both. I still think the subspecies is a useful category if it meets this very strict criteria. Mm-hmm. But as we'll get to, I'm about have decided I agree with him with subgenera. If you've got a, when we get to it, if you got a genus and you can recognize two groups of species in that genus, if they're different enough to call them subgenera, why not just make them both genera? I don't know. It doesn't seem like a useful thing to me anymore, but excuse me. And then on your outline there, it says something about varieties, races, and biotypes. We already talked about that before. That they're useful terms for like applied or ecological work and stuff, but those names don't have any validity in systematics. We don't recognize varieties, races, or biotypes anymore. They're just, so. Now, talk about the genus for a minute. Again, we already mentioned it, but the species had a good definition that you could actually go out and test. But genus, really, it's a very subjective type thing. It's just a group of related species. And each different person may have a different opinion on what species should be in each group. And so each person may have a different concept of the different genera and stuff. You hope that it's a group of species that all seem to be related, and that there'd be another group that all seem to be related, and there'd be a decided gap between them. That, you know, these they're not going to be identical species. There's variation, but they all share enough characters that you can group them together, and then these would all so have characters that again within variation, but they kind of share enough that forms a group, mm-hmm. and you can definitely tell the two. That's not always how it works. Sometimes you have two genera that appear to be very close, and so again, some people will lump things together to make a bigger genus. Some people will split them into more genera. Um, again, the whole area of phylogenetics and the cladistics and DNA has kind of been done to try to figure out what we call monophyletic groups, so that everything that's evolved from a single ancestor forms a group. And so we try to base our higher level groups on these monophyletic lineages. This family tree, you know, like if we had an ancestor here, this whole thing might be a genus, but this one here doesn't share that ancestor at this point, so this might be a second genus. So, again, it's not always easy to determine monophyletic groups. And again, it's all hypothesis testing. As we get more information, things change. A genus does have a type. We talked about species and the types. Again, it's just like with the species. You need to be able to hang a name on something. So if you had a genus with 10 species in it, and then somebody else comes along and you haven't designated which species is the type of that genus, somebody else comes along and says, well, that group of 10 species, I think it's two genera. You know, 7 of them go here and 3 go there. Well, what genus name goes with which group of species? You don't know unless you've designated a type species. You know, and when we talk about species, the type is a single specimen. When we talk about genera or a genus, the type is is the whole species. It's not just one individual. So
do the species have to have like the general characteristics for that particular genera?
Yeah, it's just yeah, you would hope that it would be very indicative of that genus. You don't get, if you've got 10 species and you've written your description for the genus, you got 10 species in there, and some are a little bit more off, different than the others. You don't want to really pick the really different one to be the type. Because there's a good chance if you pick that one, these may go someplace else, and you got this type species who doesn't really represent the name very well, but that's what it has to do. So, but yeah, anytime we describe a new genus in a publication, we have to say, okay, the type species is. They didn't always do that either. And some cases, a lot of times in the olden times, they would describe a new genus and only put one species in it. And so if they only put one species in it, that has to be the type. We call that by monotypy. But if they put two or three or four species in there and didn't designate a type, then later on somebody usually designates one of those. It has to be one of the original ones. If they originally put 3 species in a genus and somebody else put 4 more in, and then somebody even later wants to designate a type species, you have to pick one of the original 3. You can't pick one of the 4 that was added later. But that's called then type species by subsequent designation. And if you do it, if the author designates a type species when he describes the genus, it's called by original designation. Again, I'm getting, this wasn't even stuff in your notes or in my notes. And you know, I don't, this is more like what I would teach if I taught an advanced systematics class. But so, the take home here is that the genus does have a type, and it's a species, not an individual. As we mentioned before, a genus name can only be used once in the whole animal kingdom. But we've got ways to check that now, but it can be used more than once in other kingdoms. So, for example, in the plant kingdom, there's a genus called Cecropia. It's a nice big, I think it's a big leafed thing in the tropics, more or less. And in insects, we got Cecropia moths. It actually is the genus Cecropia. So there's, you can think of, I mean, there's lots of examples of that where plant name, generic names, and animal names can be the same. Okay, let's spend a few minutes now talking about the family level. One thing I wanted to emphasize is, okay, we've talked about the species level, we've talked about genus level, and now I'm going to talk about family level. And these are kind of different groups of categories. What I'm getting at is, if I name a new species, call it just Exum, and somebody else comes along and decides that this isn't a good species, it's just a subspecies. So you would have subspecies down here. This name can just rotate down into the subspecies level. If they think what I described as a species should be a new genus, this can't rotate down to the genus level. You don't call something Exum by default. So these are just, they're discrete groups of categories. Again, if you name a genus, it can rotate down, just that Bing could rotate down and be used at the subgenus level, but it can't rotate down to the family level.
Okay.
Same thing in family. You can have superfamily, and like I said, subfamily, and tribe, and names proposed in any of these categories can rotate up and down between any of these. But you can't rotate a family name into the genus level. Does that make sense? So, got kind of these just groups. Now, last time I did mention that these had particular, well, you know, standardized endings. And I think I forgot to do superfamily. But remember, this one had AD, always ends in ADIAE. Mm-hmm. This one always ends in INAE. Tribe always ends in I and I, but superfamily always ends in O-I-D-E-A, Oidea.
Yeah,
and so, yeah, if the family Pentatomidae, somebody then wants to use that name at superfamily, it just becomes Pentatomoidea, and there is a Pentatomini, and there is a Pentatomini. So, as we go up these groups, I mean, like families, you kind of hope, and usually it works out, that everything within a family, you can kind of tell they go together. They usually have similar habits. Taking from birds, the Picidae, I believe, are the woodpeckers. Well, they're all woodpeckers, a woodpecker. They all do their thing. Cerambycids are all wood boring beetles. So essentially all of them bore into wood as it matures in that. So you can see, and actually family, identifying families, the characters are usually easier and that to identify than they are at these lower levels. When you start trying to separate species, it gets more and more difficult. With exceptions, species and genera tend to be a little bit more localized geographically, whereas families tend to occur all around the world more. Like I said, again, exceptions. I know stinks. There's several species of stink bugs that occur all around the world. The Nazara virigula, the southern green stink bug, which is a major pest, occurs in Australia, South America, here, Europe, all over. But in general, they tend to be more locally distributed, where families are being much more broad. Like genus, family, the definition, it's just a group of related genera. So again, it has the same subjectivity. involved. And I don't know, somehow I was trying to, this is all put together in my notes because it had a good flow before, but it almost is like we're switching gears a little bit. And I already mentioned, we went through the types, but now we're talking about the subjectivity, I guess, is where it leads into. In placing things in these categories, and we've not always been able to do it cleanly. And so this is where we get into the couple of what I call the NIM words that I think we already talked about last time.
But synonym.
Yeah, so this is where we ended up with that synonym. Remember what a synonym was?
They have, I want to say the same name, but are two different things. And homonym is different names, but they're the same thing.
I think you may have got just the opposite.
Damn it.
Synonym is more than one name. So it can be two or more names for one, I'll just say taxon here, because it could be at the species level or it could be at the genus level. So it's where you have one species and somebody's named it, or people have named it a bunch of different times. They're all synonyms. So, whereas what you were just saying, a homonym, is when you have one name for more than one taxon. First read it, it says, aren't those the same? But no, they're just the opposite. Synonym is more than one name for one taxon. So a species may have been named a bunch of times. A homonym is where you've used the same name, but for two different organisms. Neither case is allowable. Again, the law of priority, you take the oldest name for the one name you use. We often call that oldest name. The oldest name to use is called the senior synonym. The later ones are called junior synonyms. And the same thing goes for homonyms, at least at the generic level. You often have a senior homonym, and then the others are junior homonyms. Again, this is getting a little bit more than what I expect you to know, but at the species level, we can have homonyms two different ways. I mean, we can have it where two different people name the same thing. Pentatoma fusca. Maybe Linnaeus named one Pentatoma fusca, and then a number of years later somebody else names one Pentatoma fusca. Apparently he didn't have access to Linnaeus' paper and didn't realize Linnaeus had already done that. And so two people use the exact same name, and we call that a primary homonym. And again, the older one gets credit, the younger one has to go away. Now, what happens oftentimes, though, at the species level, is say Linnaeus actually described his species, Simex fusca, and somebody else later on, he knew about what Linnaeus did, but he thought he had something different, and he named his Pentatoma fusca. And then somebody even later came and looked at Linnaeus's type and said, well, it's not a Simex, it's a Pentatoma. And so he moves this one into Pentatoma. It's still Fusca, but now you have a homonym. It wasn't originally a homonym, and so of course that's what we would call a secondary. And it's the same thing. When this happens, you still keep Linnaeus's because his is the older one. What's that?
Like, so who chooses to rename? Let's say the original identifier is dead. Who now gets
to... It's probably the person who discovers the situation gets set up. I've done a lot of them this way. I've got a lot of new names that I've proposed because I've discovered these kind of homonyms. But yeah, I'll move it in this... Might discover this, oh, this is a pentatoma, and bring it in, creates this. I said, well, okay, if this doesn't have any synonyms, you know, some other people might have had described it under different names. And if it's got some synonyms, then you got to use one of those. But if it doesn't have any synonyms, so this is the only name available, then I might come in and say, well, this has to have a new name. And a lot of times, You give credit. Say this was Fabricius that messed this up, or not really messed it up, but did this. I can say, well, I'll change this. It'll no longer be Fusca. It'll be Fabricii. But it doesn't have to be. You can name it anything you want. So the problem is you do this, and then somebody later comes along and says, well, maybe this was right. This was a pentatoma. But this one's not. This goes in a different genus. And they'll move it to Thianta. Well, now it's no longer a homonym. But somebody else may have already given a name. And so it can get a little bit confusing. But anyway, like I said, I'm giving you a little more detail than what I expect you to know. But it kind of gives you an appreciation of what I got to do. Sometimes you got to decide... Primary homonyms have got to be fixed every time. Secondary homonyms, you kind of got to weigh the situation. If they were never in the same genus at the same time, I don't think you have to fix it. But if they were ever in the same genus together, then one of them has to have a new name. And so, just for fun, I mean, again, and we still get these today. You still find new papers that will have homonyms and synonyms. But most of this comes from the old literature. And that's why my project working with cataloging has given me... I mean, I've got almost all the literature, and I've been trying to get it all organized. And so I was able to discover a lot of homonyms and stuff nobody else had noticed before because of my cataloging work. And that's the way it often works. Way back in around the 1900s to 1910, there was a couple guys that did a lot of cataloging, and they fixed a lot of homonyms at that time, too. Oh, another term I think try on your list is on there, does it say tautonym? Is that on your list? Tautonym? Any idea what a tautonym is? I don't even know what I should know what the derivation of tato is. I should look that up. Tautonym is where the genus name and the species name are the same. For example, in the stink bugs, there's a genus called Carbula, and it has a species called Carbula. And it's no real big deal. The genus and species name are the same. They call that a tautonym. Carbula, Carbula. My notes say this happens, there's more of these more frequently in the plant kingdom than there are in the animal kingdom. And actually the code recommends against this. They don't want you to do this. But example I just gave you, there's a reason why it's around. There's actually two related genera. One's called Carbula, and one's called Aspavia. And a guy named Distant a while back, I mean, they're related, And he said, well, he had a new species of Aspavia that actually looked real similar to some of the Carbula. So he named it Aspavia Carbula. Somebody later came along and said, well, you know why that looks like a Carbula? It's because it is a Carbula. And so he had to do away with that name, and that went up. And that's why how we ended up with Carbula, Carbula. So.
Wow, okay.
And then the last Nym name I've got up there is Patronym, and I think I mentioned this one already. Patro meaning father, I think, or, but Patronym is when you just name something after somebody. Like I said, I've got, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 9 patronyms. There's a number of writer eyes out there. Early in my career, I saw the opportunity. I actually named, and again, it's just fixing homonyms mainly, but I named a new genus after my wife. But she's got a kind of an unusual or different first name. But her name, her first name is Jayma, J-A-Y-M-A. And so that had never been used before, so I named a new genus just Jayma. And then I had the opportunity, I got my two sons, one's named Sean and the other one's named Stephen. And I named a new species, I think Sean, or no, they're both generic names probably, Seansonius and Stevesonius. So those would be patronyms. Okay, any questions on all that? Because we're shifting gears a little bit. I'm going to talk two more topics to do today, and then we'll quit. First of all, I want to talk about voucher specimens. You guys know about voucher specimens? Been exposed to that at all? This is more, well, even in taxonomy. I mean, our types serve as voucher specimens, but this is more pertinent to everybody else. Anytime you do any kind of research on an experimental animal, you should take examples of your animal and put them in a museum someplace.
So it's basically like, this is the showcase.
It represents your research. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people are hesitant to do that because you're not always sure that you've identified your study animal right. And so it opens the door for somebody later to come along and say, well, you didn't have what you thought you did. It's actually this. And nobody wants to be pointed out that you made a mistake, right? But if you do all this hard work and come up with really good data and say it belong, you know, I worked on this species, and then you didn't put any specimens, voucher specimens, in a museum. 10 or 15 years later, somebody comes along and says, well, you know, this species, they now recognize it as to be two different species. You know, and if you didn't leave specimens, what does your data go to? Does it go to the one you thought it was, or does it go here? And if you can't figure it out, your data is lost. Nobody knows what to do with it. It may still have some pertinence, but, and so it's far better to put specimens in a collection and be humble. If somebody comes along and says you didn't have what you had, say, okay, you know, things have changed and da da da. But at least now we can still pinpoint my data goes with this, and it's still usable to the scientific community. Mm-hmm. So, and I think, I know whether they enforce it anymore or still enforcing or not, but I know a lot of the entomological journals in the U.S., the ESA journals, Entomological Society of America, mm-hmm. used to have in there that you had to tell where you placed your voucher specimens so before they would publish your paper. So, again, because of variation, you don't want to just place one specimen. You should place a series of specimens, you know, a few, several to up to 10 or so. You should try to have some of both sexes. If you're working on immature forms, you should have some of the immature forms in there too. So, again, it just serves as something somebody can go back and look at and say, ah, now I know what for sure what he had, and this data is still usable, and bang, bang, bang. So, and then the last thing that I wanted to talk about, again, in this class, we really go on and on about the scientific names. I've spent all this time. But we should also talk a little bit about common names. And there's my notes kind of say, I guess I should see how it's set up here. Yep, it's, well, common names, there's like three different categories of common names. There's the common names where people just, the local people kind of make them up. Say, oh, look, there's a
toe biter.
Yeah, toe biter, or there goes a red stink bug. Let's call that the red stink bug. And the trouble with those is, you know, even you in the north end of town and somebody in the south end of town, would you might say, oh, look, there's a red stink bug. Let's call it the red stink bug from now on. And somebody in the south end of town says, yeah, it's red, but I'm going to call it the crimson stink bug. You can have lots of common names for one individual. In fact, my notes give some examples. For example, the European water lily has 15 English common names, 44 French, 105 German, and 81 Dutch for 245 different common names. And these notes are old too, so who knows. Another category of common names are those that are kind of used a little bit more standardized in textbooks and things, in journals and stuff, but it was mainly by researchers who just didn't want to have to use the scientific name all the time, so they would just use a common name. Mm-hmm. And then the third category is the standardized common names. There began to, just like in true taxonomy, we saw a need to have some guidelines and stuff and the International Code of Nomenclature and all that. Common names, they saw that need too. And since around 1900 again, at least in the U.S., we've had guidelines that guide us on how to form common names. For example, should everything have common name?
Yes.
In a sense.
It's for people who aren't exactly scientists, because dialectically, colloquially, because how else do you communicate that?
But
I'm trying to play devil's advocate here. On the other hand, if we don't have common names, then never mind. I can't remember that right now.
I mean, if we can get everyone to use scientific names, and everyone knows what everyone's talking about.
Yep.
But see, I think we undersell the public. That is one of the reasons for having common names, is we say the general public doesn't want to use scientific names. They don't use scientific names as much in, say, the insect world, but lots of the plant names are scientific names. Mm-hmm. Chrysanthemum, you know, there's a whole bunch of those are the generic names. And the public does just fine using all those. The trouble to be why you don't really want everything to have a common name is then why not just use the scientific name? Why have two names for everything? Mm-hmm. And so generally speaking, the guidelines are is we only do provide approve common names for economically important pests, or not even pests, economically important species. Could be beneficials, or they could be pests. Or some of the more popular things. I mean, monarch butterfly. It's not really agriculturally important either way. Mm-hmm. But so things that are really common and the public sees usually gets common names. Mm-hmm. And things that are economically important, either good or bad, often get common names. The Entomological Society of Florida a while back decided they were going to try to give common names to everything that occurred in Florida. And the scientific community kind of railed on them and said, no, 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 no. You need to mean, we already have a standardized set of common names for the United States. We don't want your society to go off rogue on your own and fold in with all the rest of us. And so there actually is a procedure that has to be gone through. In fact, they used to publish periodically a book of the standardized common names in the United States. You may still be able to get a copy of the book, but again, now everything's on the internet. So you can find the standardized common name list for the United States on the internet. But you couldn't, you can't just propose one and say, all right, from now on I'm going to call this aphid the Timbuktu aphid or whatever. You have to, in the United States, you actually have to fill out some forms and make a proposal. There is a committee with the ESA, Entomological Society of America, that governs, that looks over the common names. And so you have to fill out a form and make a proposal to them. They'll review it, and then they actually publish the name. I don't know if you guys, are you members of the ESA?
I should become one.
Yeah, that'd probably be a good thing. But they send out a monthly newsletter by the internet, and every once in a while in that newsletter there'll be new common name proposals listed. You know, say, here's the following common names that people have proposed. And so it gets published, and then there's a comment period. So it goes for a month or two where people can write in and say, yeah, that's a good common name, or no, we shouldn't have that as a common name because it's too close to this. Or, but it gives a period of time for people to comment whether they agree or disagree on the common name proposal. And if there's not a lot of comments against it, then the committee will approve it, and there'll be a new common name added to our standardized list. And like I said, this is for the United States. Other countries may have more or less standardized ways. I know Australia, I think they have maybe some standardized common names. But they don't always agree with ours, and some of ours don't make much sense. I mean, the stink bug I talked about that's a pest in the United States is called the southern green stink bug because it occurs in the southern part of the United States. Well, in Australia, it's more of a pest in the northern half because they're in the other hemisphere. It likes the warmer weather. Mm-hmm. So southern green stink bug doesn't make a lot of sense to them. I think they call it the green vegetable bug or something like that. So one thing that I like to common names, yeah, there's still a couple things I want to hit. Way back, again, somebody proposed this, and again, it's not a hard, fast rule, but it is something that I try to do. When we talk about different common names, you'll get things. There'll be some common names where you don't know whether to write them as one word or two words. For example, stink bug. Is it one word or two words?
One word? I've never seen it.
I want to say two. I'm trying to remember. Okay, ladybug, it's one word. So it'd be two words because it's a bug. And bugs are, I don't know.
Usually, I'm trying to do the same thing you're doing. Look at examples. And I don't know if ladybug is always written that way or not. But some that I do know is like dragonfly is always one word. Okay. I've never seen it split in two. Is that organism really a fly?
No. That's why.
So if it's not what it really is, you make it one word. In my case, stink bug, it actually is a stink bug. So generally speaking, stink bug is two words.
Okay. And I'm not crazy.
So. You get it? Think of another easy one. Another easy one. Butterfly is always one word.
Yeah. It's
is it really a fly?
It's not really a fly. Oh, okay, so.
So in his case, ladybug would be two words. But if you say, some people call it a lady beetle.
That's not really a beetle. Well, Coccinella is Coleoptera. It's really a beetle, isn't it?
Yeah, so lady beetle would be one word.
It's confusing.
Okay.
Again, think of butterfly, dragonfly. Those you always know are always spelled as one word. Mm-hmm. They're not a fly. So if they're not what they really are, you make it one word. If they are what they really are, it's two words.
Penitomidae falls in under hemipterans.
Yeah, penitomidae is the stink bug.
Okay. They're not Coleoptera, so there's... Okay. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Metcalf, in 1942, proposed that group name be written as a separate word when the term was systematically correct. So housefly is always two words. Wait a minute, housefly. Yeah.
Yeah, two words.
Yeah.
And so I think what's confusing you is I did these wrong.
Ladybug and lady beetle.
Ladybug.
Yeah, that was what was confusing.
Yeah, ladybug.
I usually see it as ladybug.
It's not a bug, so it'd be like these. Lady beetle would be two words.
Okay.
That's probably what confused you. So I did that wrong. So.
You can also just call it lady bird beetle, but yeah. That's just because I've been calling it that for last year.
This is what we use.
The other problem, another problem with common names is that they tend, at least to the general public, you kind of think it gives people the false impression that things are related when they're not. Mm-hmm. For example, army worm. There's lots of species called something army worm, the brown army worm, the dusky army worm, but they're not all related. They'll be in a lot of different families within the Lepidoptera. And the public may think, well, they're all the same. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all related to each other, and they're not. So sometimes common names give the false impression that things are related when they're not. Now, the last thing that I was going to say with common names, if I were to ask you which is more stable, common names or scientific names, what would you say?
That's a hard one.
You're going to need to define what stable means to me.
Changes.
Oh,
whether
yeah. How flu. Okay. How
common names.
Yeah.
There you go.
I want to say common names are more stable.
Yeah.
I'm going to agree with him there.
And see, and most people would, because scientific names, oh, that's what the scientists use. They got to be more stable. But it actually is. We've spent a lot of time on the lectures talking about how scientific names change.
Yeah.
You know, but... Like the southern green stink bug. You know, southern green stink bug is Nazara virigula. People may move it to a different genus or may have a different species name, but it will always be the southern green stink bug. Mm-hmm. So no matter how the scientific name changes, the common name will stay the same if it's these standardized ones anyway. So yeah, there's a tendency for common names to be a little more stable. They don't change as much anyway. As much as scientific names do. And there, that finishes that lecture. Like I said, as of right now, unless tonight they come out and say, we messed up on the weather, it's gonna be 75 to 80 and bright and sunny, I'll change my mind and send you, did you guys get the email yesterday afternoon I sent? Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I slept in a little bit so I can, you know, get some sleep.
Well. Unless the weather looks like it improves, I'm just planning on probably lecturing again Thursday and Friday. And
yeah. And then this would depend on his schedule, but I did notice that next Monday and Tuesday are relatively sunny. I know Monday isn't usually our class day, but again, it would depend on what your plans are. But I was wondering if we could try to get out on Monday as well as Tuesday. I'm also going to call off Tuesday for, you know, that reason. Like, call work off.
I would be open to going. I could go, especially like we've been doing, I can go locally about any day. Mm-hmm. If I can work it out, I can. Like, today would have been good if the weather wasn't so bad, because. But the reason for everything is because the weather was bad. Mm-hmm. My son, he's still working today, but his housemate who works with him, since it's all wet and that, they're not doing landscape stuff. And so his roommate's staying at home and watching his dog for him. So I'm free all day today. I could have gone out for a whole day collecting today, mm-hmm. but I didn't know that until this morning. So it's hard for me to plan ahead.
Yeah, I saw it raining yesterday, and I was like, that's not going to happen, is it?
I knew it was supposed to rain, but I think we got more than they thought it would. We were supposed to, and so...